find out. We'll give it another 3 or 4 minutes. The decision to crank this up and let the green people infiltrate through the permeable doors at the back here. No, I'm Patrick Pennell. I'm an architect and planner in Connecticut. I'm the purported moderator of this session on largest, the urbanism of big buildings. I'm joined up here by, bracketed actually by a couple of guys from HOK, the world's largest architecture firm, though they're in different offices. Immediately to my right is Eric Anderson, who's HOK Chicago. He's a design principal in the Chicago office. They do a lot of large healthcare facilities. Eric and Dave Groisel will be bracketing Steve Luoni, who's University of Arkansas Community Design Center, who has done work for the infamous Walmart down in Arkansas. So you've heard of that particular large venue. Dave Groisel from HOK Sport in Kansas City is a principal of HOK Sport Venue Event, which is, does a lot of very large assembly buildings. We were kind of trading notes before this and planning the session and determined that we were genial opponents in the effort to save Fenway Park. I was on the side of the decision to save the oldest ballpark in Major League Baseball, and he was not. And but we're going to have a genial conversation about ballparks, which are a particularly interesting kind of big assembly place in terms of the relationship to the city. I should also credit Zach Borders right up here as the originator of the rather clever title, which I think all of you will understand is a kind of covert reference to one of the Congress's oldest and most ingenious opponents, Rem Koolhaas, and his SMLXL book from about 10 years ago now. Funny little, here's a bit of architectural trivia for you. Leo Creer, who's one of the resident patron saints of NU, and Rem Koolhaas shared an office together in New York in 1978, courtesy of Peter Eisenman. Now, I can explain that if anybody wants, but that is historical fact, and I think much has proceeded from there. My role today, besides being the immoderator on this big topic, is to, I think, step back and set the game board, kind of say something about what may be at stake here with the current largest set of buildings around. I'm going to be your sort of court jester in setting this up, and we'll, I hope, talk about things of both of a pragmatic and a philosophical sort. So I'm trying to deliberately be a little bit surreal right from the beginning by showing this René Magritte painting of what's either a very large apple or a very small room, and suggesting that context is all. That's really what we're going to be discussing, I'm sure, aside from size in an absolute sense. And I want to prefigure the larger discussion, by pointing out how societies, how cultures over history have spent their largest quantities of money is very revealing of those cultures. The Greeks, I'm symbolizing that here with a gridded Greek town, spent their money on temples and on fortification walls. Their ideas survived. The Greek unity did not. The Romans spent their money on temples and on roads. They survived as a kind of more pragmatic set of doing things. Where they spent, those two cultures, their infrastructure money, is a real kind of revelation of the kinds of legacies that they've left for us. Now, we're in a time when there are super large things being built, both secular, I'm taking a sort of random shopping mall conglomeration next to a random bit of infrastructure, and sacred, the mega churches, which are part of the phenomenon of largeness in our time. One thing that's really interesting about both of those is that they typically don't have context. We've had big buildings in world history before, St. Peter's here, but for the most part, they have grown up with and helped sponsor context. There's been a kind of reciprocal relationship between the large institutional building and the other places around that constitute the city. St. Peter's has a set of architectural arms which reach out towards the city and symbolically express that kind of relationship, the kind of reciprocal back and forth between what's after all just a very big box, the dome of Saint, with a dome on top of it. St. Peter's doesn't have any parking requirement, but that's still another question. And there's a kind of symbolism of reciprocal relationship that's there in the architecture. When you see some of the things in the context of no context big boxes, you wonder, you know, this is our lord of the power lines and the water supply. In what salvation is constituted in our contemporary use of large buildings is really, I think, one of the things that's problematized, as they say in academia, when you start to contemplate the issue of big buildings. There is a whole set not only of pragmatic but symbolic issues. What do these mean for the culture? What does it mean in world cultural and not just architectural context when Rem Koolhaas is building items like the China Communication Center for the new Olympics? What does it mean, if anything, if you have super large interior-focused casinos like New York, in Las Vegas, which is far more surreal, to my judgment, than anything René Magritte ever did? And you find these images of these things floating around on the internet. They begin to look, they begin to be astonishingly like one of the great mythical big buildings of culture, the Tower of Babel, in which, of course, the biggest building was ultimately the source of the largest loss of meaning, the dissolution of the common language of communication. Everybody was atomized individually by this effort to be the largest, the biggest, the tallest. Again, when you see large museums of striking form, what's called into question now is the relationship between those structures, I'm symbolizing it with Frank Gehry's Bilbao, obviously, and the traditional city. We're in a time when the possibility of big boxes coming into the city or traditional urbanism surrounding big boxes in their current venues on the peripheries is a really big and interesting issue. Now, I'm going to rewind just for a bit, since, as I say, my job is to be the court jester or the provocateur. I'd like to remind everybody that we're really still exploring what modernity means. We're really still playing out the kinds of ideas and mechanisms, social mechanisms, changes of government that began only 250 years ago, you know, really with the American and French revolutions. That was a time on the one hand, there was an attempt to make institutions and ideas like the encyclopedia written or Boulez's library to contain all knowledge. You know, and what is that but a 250-year-old version of the internet? We're at this kind of problematic issue of size and complexity and what it means all over again. And of course, it was also the juncture, which is still very critical to how architecture is done, of classicism and romanticism, of the aspiration to beauty and the aspiration to the sublime. And Boulez, Etienne Louis Boulez's project for Newton's cenotaph is another one of these kind of interesting, paradoxical big buildings from the history of architecture. It was an attempt to contain the universe symbolically in one building, in the single large building that was the gravesite of the guy, Isaac Newton, who'd figured out how it all worked. So, very large thing, essentially, for one guy. Another kind of large building that's coming back into play, of course, is the tallest skyscraper. Here I'm showing you Calatrava's new skyscraper for Chicago, which is just now beginning. It's an old kind of building for Chicagoans because, of course, here's Frank Lloyd Wright's Mile High skyscraper from 1956 for a site not very far from the Calatrava site. I'll tell a quick anecdote about Frank Lloyd Wright and then wind out here and hand this off. Apparently, at one point, some dumb young architect said, Mr. Wright, can I give you a tour of my new building? And Wright went along with it and said, and at the end of the tour, the young architect said, well, Mr. Wright, I wonder if I could ask you what you think of my new building. And Wright, expansive as always, said, well, son, we all do God's work, you in your way and I in his. And, the interesting thing about that is that what Wright was positing was that he was at the tip of the spire directly communicating with the meaning of the universe. You know, that's really what that means. All that kind of institutional intervention between the individual and the largest cosmic meaning was gone in that kind of revealing moment. The question, I think, about a lot of these large institutions that we've got, largest, is are they large and meaningful, or are they large and meaningless? You know, Wright's skyscraper, one person on top, is ultimately maybe St. Simeon Stylites in the desert contemplating things all by himself. And it's funny the way that this all-encompassing sphere and the point wind up showing up again and again symbolically in particularly 20th century architecture and in the various degrees of variously mad big structures that architects and planners have proposed over the years. You know, it's time now, because of the green movement, that we really stop to think again about Paolo Soleri's mile-high megastructures. Are these things proposed 30-some, 40-some years ago now something that we should take seriously as pragmatic solutions, or just as a kind of Jungian outpouring of the desire for an architecture which is man-made but is also fundamentally natural, reassuring us of our place in the world, you know, in the kind of way that W.R. Lethaby explored in the late 19th century with his drawing of the Templeless Mountain. I want to point out that I think that that idea of the building as landscape is something that one really has to look at seriously, whether it's a groundscraper, as Leo Creer calls them, big box, or in the stuff that the Scharchitects are doing these days. Here's Danny Libeskind with one or another of his pointy things, and how's that for acute criticism? Here is Caspar David Friedrich's Wreck of the Hope, a romantic painting from the early 19th century. I think there's a pretty good argument to be made that a lot of the Scharchitecture that you see is really a nostalgia for the sublime, as it was announced in the late 18th century by Edmund Burke. Traditional architects tend to look for and try to produce the beautiful. The Scharchitects tend to produce something that aspires to be a kind of horrifying landscape. Frank Gehry, it's very interesting to see the way that his buildings are presented, shot, photographed. They look like nothing so much as Turner paintings or Albert Bierstadt, you know, and I'm sure that Frank Gehry would be incensed if he was told that really what he was aspiring to be was the architect who made Albert Bierstadt paintings three-dimensional. But I think there's a pretty good case for that. In Peter Calthorpe's presentation about Dubai, up in the upper left-hand corner of some of his slides, we're speaking of largest, Palm Island, which is a city which is, again, patently exploring the same kind of paradox of the most artificial thing trying to assert that it's the most natural, the biggest thing trying to assert that it's as fundamental as landscape. What's going on here? You know, I don't have the answer to that question, but I think that beyond the pragmatics of doing some of these things, we're obliged to think about what's going on with Palm Island in Dubai, what's going on with Rem Koolhaas in Dubai. Rem, as I say, is the maybe the most sophisticated critic of contemporary architecture and culture around. He's extraordinarily cynical about it. It is the culture of consumption and not the culture of salvation of the which is historically what institutions like St. Peter's and its encompassing dome have symbolized. Whether this other circle, whether this is an accurate characterization of what Walmart really wants out of you, we'll see what Steve says on this. But it's at the very least an interesting question when you contemplate large gatherings of people for what purpose. So with that, your court jester is going to retire and hand off after the obligatory technical glitchery here while we change computers. 2 seconds. The manual dexterity coefficient is not high this morning.
We're close. Okay. Well, thank you, Patrick. That was very inspiring, a very great start to a discussion on largest and whatever buildings. I'm here to talk to you about hospital design, why that is important to all of you and to all of us in the industry, and any discussion on urbanism, is that we are in a cycle, it's been going on for over 15 years, in which many of the healthcare facilities around the country are going through a program of replacement of their facilities. And I have done work at a number of large academic medical centers and hospitals throughout the country in large urban settings, and they offer significant challenges. That today I would like to talk to you about a project, Northwestern Memorial Hospital's Galter Feinberg Pavilion. It was completed in 1999 in Chicago. It's interesting that when this project was conceived in the early 90s, our client received great criticism, because while they chose to consolidate, many of their peer institutions were actually outsourcing or moving their facilities into multiple facilities out to the communities that they served, particularly in the outpatient services. So here we had a client that had a radical idea of consolidating both outpatient and inpatient services into one large structure. And this facility is located in the Northwestern University Medical Campus in a vibrant downtown Chicago neighborhood. This really is then the story of how this 2 million square foot facility actually transformed not only a medical center campus, but also a neighborhood. And here we are almost 10 years later, and the foundation that was laid by this groundbreaking project has paid great dividends to the client and to the community. I've organized this brief presentation. I wanted to give you all a brief historical context about hospitals as a building typology, a little bit about the Chicago urban context in which this project was done, then a discussion on specifically what the project was, and then finish out with what were attributes for success of this particular project, but I think they hold true for any academic or any large medical facility in an urban setting. If we look back, some of the first hospitals that we know of were 2,000 years ago, built by the Romans. They served to take care of their soldiers and gladiators. They were the property of the state. It was a good idea to take care of your assets. They may have been located near communities, but they certainly would not have been welcoming to the general public. We move over to the medieval times, and now the churches have put the hospitality into hospitals. They were often a place where people went to die. There weren't a lot of treatment options. So these facilities associated with churches may have been and were located in communities, but they certainly would not be a place that you'd likely go simply because it might be fatal. So as we progress then into the 1700s and 1800s, where there began to be a better understanding of treatment or of diseases and a rudimentary understanding of some of the treatments, the typology that you see here actually looks more like a palace, a walled city. And in fact, many of the hospital facilities created at this time had separate pavilions, each pavilion representing a different treatment modality, all within a walled city. I think oftentimes to keep the community out, but sometimes to keep the patients in. So a great number of asylums were built to take care of the mentally infirm. We take a quick jump ahead to the early 20th century America, the birth of the Academic Medical Center, in which its core mission was to educate physicians or educate students to become physicians in a clinical setting, with its core mission being education, research, and taking care of patients. Taking care of patients was really just to help students learn. But you can see, even when you look at these images, they were located within communities, but were still somewhat isolated. They were not necessarily connected in any integrated way. If we look at specifically hospital design after World War II, as the advances of medical technology, hospitals became machines for healing. And so to the bizarre extent that the image on the left is a Bertram Goldberg building, the Prentice Stone Hospital in Chicago. And in this case, the machine for healing has been lifted up off the street. You would wonder where the front door is, but I guess when you go in it, you would be sucked up, taken care of, then spit out. But clearly very unfriendly in terms of an urban urban gesture. And then finally, as we progress into the 1990s, there became a recognition, a new attitude of patients first. It was an acknowledgement by healthcare providers that that patients were consumers. And they needed to create environments that would attract and retain both patients and physicians. And so Northwestern Memorial Hospital, the Galter Feinberg Pavilion, was conceived within that framework as that next generation of hospital. Talk a little bit about the urban context. Chicago, you can see the image, the one image in 1901, very clearly defined grid. The growth of the city was exponential after the Chicago Fire of 1871. The circle that you see just north of downtown, represents the Streeterville neighborhood in which the Galter Feinberg Pavilion was created. The arrow represents Michigan Avenue, a vital corridor that was part of the Burnham Plan that I'm going to show you some images of how it evolved. The spire that Patrick was talking about is actually being constructed right here. The story of Northwestern Memorial Hospital, you really do have to look at the context of the city. And so the city here, we're looking at images of Michigan Avenue as it extended northward and became known as the Magnificent Mile, home to many of the luxury retail and commercial businesses. It is home of many of the iconic buildings of Chicago, both in the early part of the century and the later part of the century. And then we, in a parallel path, the Streeterville neighborhood grew. And here is an image of the Streeterville neighborhood in 1929 when Northwestern University decided to open a Chicago campus. They located their medical school. And as you can see by this photo, an isolated academic medical center, but there's nothing much around it. And so over time, what has happened is that Michigan Avenue corridor has expanded. The residential areas around Streeterville have expanded. And so by the time we got to the early 90s, the medical center and the university had expanded and had met now the residential and commercial neighborhood. So the question was, as Northwestern moved forward and they implemented this project of such enormous scale, how would they address the surrounding community? And here you see the completed project, and in fact, it was intended to reach out to the community, and I'll go through that in a little greater detail. Specifics of the project, the 2 million square feet, both outpatient and inpatient facilities, you can see here a 22-story outpatient facility, a 16-story inpatient building. They're joined on a common base, diagnostic and treatment base of 8 stories. One of the key elements is a 3-story base of public functions, both lobby and amenities. As with any big urban project, parking became an issue, and still remains an issue, but parking facilities were located both at the perimeter of the campus and centrally located for visitors to provide proximity of parking to clinical destinations. The building was organized, as I had mentioned, with the public base of multiple stories to allow a lot of public amenities, the diagnostics above, and then the various inpatient and outpatient facilities. But this city within a city was designed very specifically with an idea of wayfinding in mind. So you see the yellow that's represented here is the organization of the building in such a way that the internal circulation for the public and the public elevators were associated with one edge of the project to allow for views out and to allow for a sense of orientation as patients, families, and staff move through the building. So now we get to a discussion of what are some of the attributes that have made this project successful and I think can make any urban medical center successful. There are a number of, and this is by no means exhaustive, but there are a number of issues that I think that worked very well for us. One was developing with our client a clear understanding of the edges of the campus, understanding that the campus extended from Michigan Avenue all the way over to Lakeshore Drive and the lake, that there were street edges along the north edge with a major public park, and then to the south a major east-west artery that essentially defined the Northwestern University and medical campus. Developing the circulation patterns that would allow access into that site for both public service and emergency vehicles became a challenge, particularly with the one-way street systems of Chicago, so there's close attention paid to how to orchestrate that. Entries and access points. Here you see the Galter Feinberg Pavilion, the outpatient facility, the inpatient facility. There is a drive-through the middle. There are major drop-offs here. Major entry points around the perimeter. In this case, vehicles can drop and then get into parking. Here's the emergency department located at a very accessible arrival point into the campus. Below the garage that houses 2,000 cars is a service dock that accommodates deliveries not only for the Galter Feinberg Pavilion, but for other buildings on the campus. It is entered through a ramp here located on the left. I know you all will hate this, but academic medical centers in an urban setting, or in many settings, do require linkages, not only at the ground level, but in this kind of climate, above the street and over the street in the form of bridges. So this was a pattern that was set up early on in which we defined what would be a bridge level that tied into some of the existing bridges but laid the groundwork for what would be future bridges that have, in many cases, since been implemented. But it's a pattern that allows for safe and convenient access to multiple buildings around the campus for patients and staff. When we looked at how the building would be placed within the campus, we looked at the existing massing surrounding the campus. We recognized that the placement of the outpatient facility on the west edge here would give it close proximity to a very vibrant Michigan Avenue, that vibrant commercial retail corridor that I spoke of, and would become the entry, the arrival sequence for people coming from Michigan Avenue, so the outpatient facilities that see the most traffic at the west end. And you can even see in the hierarchy of the massing, the stepping down towards the lake. We look at the cohesive architectural character that defines the Galter Feinberg Pavilion, derived in many ways from some of the preceding buildings, Wesley and Passavant Hospitals, two of the original hospitals seen below. I think what's interesting to me is that it's a great example of how a city is a living organism. So even though these two original buildings have now been demolished, their DNA has been passed on. And it was passed on through the Galter Feinberg Pavilion and continues to be passed on with subsequent buildings within the campus. That particular aesthetic described the buildings as pavilions in which the corners may be sculpted and recede from the urban edge. That allowed us to create what we were calling high-identity image corners at all the corners of the site to give it a better sense of identity and image. Any development of a large medical campus needs to anticipate the future growth, and so there are a number of scenarios that were developed early on in this project, and there really needs to be a recognition that you don't know what the future holds. But certainly, when we were considering siting the building, and it took us a year to site the building, we looked at the multiple options of where the most optimal site would be in terms of future expansion. It is interesting to note that the client has subsequently bought the building that is across the street from the ambulatory outpatient facility, and they are now housing many of their growing physician practices there. In any academic or any medical campus within urban or not environment, pedestrian-friendly streetscape certainly is a way to tie things together. We explored many of the existing conditions that were on the campus and developed street edges that allowed for access at multiple points, but developed along the east here a plaza as an arrival zone for much of the traffic coming from the south. The west, the development of a plaza that between the building they subsequently bought and the outpatient building as the front door from Michigan Avenue. There was close attention paid to the detailing of the streetscape in terms of the horizontal surfaces. The vertical elements of the building, the precast and the granite coming down and then, in fact, blending into the horizontal surfaces of the streetscape. And then the actual plants, lighting, seating that were incorporated to give a cohesiveness to the campus that has been taken forward in subsequent project development. And now we get to what I think is really the most groundbreaking element of the project. It's accessibility, not only to patients and physicians, but to the general public. So what our client chose to do was to actually open their doors to the surrounding community. This was unheard of at the time, but what they were doing is we built a three-story base for them. We talked about creating an area for public functions, public amenities, and they have slowly over the years filled it. Now they have over half a dozen retail functions. There's a bank, there's a Walgreens, there's a Starbucks, there's Abal Pond, there's even the cafeteria draws an enormous amount of traffic from the surrounding business community because the food's that good. So here, rather than turn their backs on the community, Northwestern opened their doors and invited the community in to become part of their community. And now we get to, just in closing, a couple of the challenges that we continue to see on that campus and we've talked to our client about. The one of urban open space. You think of any great urban campus, an open space, a significant open space is clearly an element that helps organize and define a campus and give it a sense of identity. But it also competes against high real estate prices and programmatic needs. So whereas the architects and the new urbanists might dream of a beautiful urban space, it's very difficult to achieve with those things in mind. And parking, any big project, this is the challenge. And it's so difficult to find the agreeable solutions. For healthcare projects, parking needs to be proximate to the destination because many times patients are not necessarily the most ambulatory people, so we need to get them close to the front door. In the case of Northwestern, we chose to locate staff garages with many of them having retail components at the base, at the perimeter, and then the central parking garage here feeding into the Galter Feinberg Pavilion. But I think in the future there has to be ways of developing either greenscapes for the roofs of these garages or more retail components in the base, because it's just a sad fact of modern life that the car is the most popular means of transportation. And in closing, I spoke with our client about this presentation about a month ago, and he said that one of the great challenges they face now is understanding what is the capacity of the campus, how much can they grow, and they have grown significantly. They just opened another million square foot women's hospital just two blocks north of the Galter Feinberg Pavilion. There's a children's hospital that is moving in just next door, another million square feet. So what our client was telling me is that, at some point, what point do we reach capacity where we begin to degrade the experience not only for our patients and our staff but for the surrounding community? And those are some of the challenges that we face with these large academic or large medical centers in urban environments. With that, I'm going to pass it over to Steve.
Thanks. Well, everyone knows who HOK is, so I thought I'd take a minute to talk about who UACDC is. We're an outreach center of the School of Architecture in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Our mission is to promote creative development in Arkansas through education, research, and design solutions. We have a staff of four, professional full-time staff of planners and architects who work with students, much like in a teaching hospital. And we'll work with any entity, profit or nonprofit, NGOs, cities, communities, developers, corporations who share our mission to promote creative development in Arkansas. We're a pretty well triangulated organization. We work with state agencies, NGOs inside and outside of Arkansas. We now have EPA as a client, Habitat for Humanity as a client, and we work with colleges throughout the university, School of Public Policy, School of Sam Walton School of Business Development, and Ecological and Civil Engineering. So we're not only creating models and projects, but we're also attempting to create learning networks within our state that will promote creative development. 3 years ago, Walmart asked us to do a study on the prototype big box, mostly a super center that's about 200,000 square feet with another 300,000 square feet in parking. That equals about, it's about 5-10 city blocks, and it's well beyond the limit of the walkable 5-acre block that's seen as the maximum for walkability. So this is not really a project plan that I'll show you. This is really a model that we're developing for big box, finding a social in big box retail, and best practices, best planning and design practices that go with that. And the cover of this book, which I think it's on our website, you can get a web-based version of this book. It's a 200-page book, Finding a Social in Big Box Retail. You can see on the cover the issue, the environmental issues that we're confronting. And I would say this, I'm not sure that largeness or bigness is the problem. I think it's the smoothness of the environment. And what do I mean by that? First of all, the environment is, if you look at the top frame, typically these big boxes are located in exurban, non-urban environments, and they're characterized by low connectivity but high proximity. So it uses an arterial cul-de-sac logic of connectivity. Second, there are automobile-only fabrics dominated by parking and automobile traffic. Third, you see in a third frame, the buildings themselves lack porosity. And in fact, we tell Walmart that their stores aren't really stores. They're the last warehouse in a chain of warehouses. So there's really no kind of architectural content to the store itself. As you can see in the bottom two frames, the environments are completely homogenous. They're monocultures that really lack the complexity, the social complexity and the architectural complexity of historic markets. So I don't think bigness is necessarily the problem. I think it's complicated by bigness. If you look at souks and bazaars and, again, historic market types, they were just as large or larger, but they were fraught with complexity, both social complexity, complexity in the physical space, and it was really a framework for classic mercantilism. So what's the challenge? I think the challenge is pretty similar to the challenge that modern planning and design has always faced with the development of new prototypes. We see this in the convention center. We see it in the airport, the train station, the office building. How do we take new types, new conditions, and infuse an architectural and planning culture in those types? And it's an incremental process. So what I'm going to show you is not going to revolutionize anything. Rather, it's the first step in building an architectural and planning language to a right now an unprecedented, unworkable condition. I want to say something briefly about largeness in the economy. These numbers that you see here were 3 years ago. They're radically outdated. For instance, I think on one number you see that Walmart is only superseded by 17 other international economies. Well, now in the 3 years that's been reduced to seven. There's only seven larger economies in the world that are larger than Walmart, and they're growing. I think 1.2 million employees were indicated there. They're well over 2 million now and growing. They advance at the level of, they grow every year by the level of a Microsoft. But they're not the only ones. I mean, category killers have been with us for 150 years. Ever since Montgomery Ward's and Sears, subsequently the department store, the mall, and now the power centers, the last 150 years of retailing has been defined by revolution in building technologies and, most importantly, revolution in supply chain technologies. So the mom-and-pop retailer, the small merchant that's always defined retail and the community, the marketplace in the community, has really been effectively squeezed out for the last 150 years. So the idea of the category killer has been with us for quite a while. In the next year, the top five big box retailers will open 600 stores. Walmart will open one half of those, that's nationally. So they open close to a store a day. So if it's not Walmart, it's going to be someone else. My point being that it's simply the economy in which we exchange goods. So it doesn't really have to do with a specific corporation or retailer. It's the economic condition we're in. To give you a sense of scale, Walmart alone purchases $1 billion in real estate per month. So what do you do? We were asked to do a study on a prototypical store 3 years ago, and I guess we developed two design instruments, the first one being a transect, and I guess that's what urbanists do. When they don't know what to do, you develop a transect. And so we developed a transect consisting of five ecotones to the typical lot. Again, it's a 200,000 square foot super center, that's about 5 acres. The parking alone constitutes about 60% of the property development. So there are a couple assumptions here. First of all, we couldn't touch the box itself. The box is a highly complex and sophisticated logistics project in which every product in the store is highly negotiated and studied with its suppliers. So that was off the table. The thing that we could look at was the 60% of the site development, the parking lot, and the edge of the store. The other thing we were to assume is that regardless of the work we would do, Walmart was not going to run out the next day and build structured parking, mixed-use development, or locate in dense urban sites. So we were trying to be practical and really start to initiate this study with a phased development where the model that I'm going to show you is by no means complete, but it's the first step in thinking about good community relations. Keep in mind, Walmart gets sued every hour and 45 minutes. They have 8,000 cases pending at one point. Half of those cases are community relations. Our argument being that good design is a better business model, can save you the money. So everything that I will show you is cost effective. Just to give you an example of how the organization is structured, there are 15 designers opening a store every day. There are 200 attorneys, not to mention the hundreds of others that are on retainer by Walmart. Designers are cheaper than attorneys. So if you just did the right thing, you could provide better community relations, better space, and save money. The second instrument that we looked at, and I'll discuss this further in terms of frontage, but looking at community building elements, looking at traditions of porch, of loges, of courts, atriums, those things that have always defined great architecture. And most of great architecture is a box with fantastic frontage. And so what we're trying to do is inflect within this generic context great examples of architectural traditions. Looking to the first design instrument, we developed five ecotones to the project and a typical prototypical development, the first being the street frontage, then the outer parking ring, an inner parking ring, the built-in frontage, what Paco Underhill calls a decompression zone, which is the first 40 feet in the store, and the checkouts. And we found that in each ecotone there was opportunity. And it's not as generic, it is generic, but it's not as monotonous as it may seem to be. And what this is trying to do is develop an ecology, looking at all the procedures, the agencies that control these different zones, the possibilities in each zone. What could each zone sponsor? And we look at street frontage. The highway department controls a lot of that frontage. And so what we were trying to do in the first ecotone is develop possibilities for context-sensitive highway development. How can Walmart or any big box retailer, develop in such a way so that streets can once again become better pedestrian-oriented streets. And so we looked at pocket parks, logistics porches, atriums. We looked at commercial courts, which would be the supplementary tenants that Walmart accommodates on their site, and really trying to figure out how to sandwich parking in between that layer and the big box. Keep in mind, the amount of parking that we need, which is five spaces per 1,000 square feet, that's 1,500 square feet of parking for 1,000 square feet of retail, is typically mandated by most communities. As a matter of fact, it's a big fight with the community to get them to reduce their parking. So by code, this is the parking that we're dealing with. In the outer parking ring and inner parking ring, the outer parking ring, the 40% of the typical parking lot, is only used 2% of the year. And so what we're suggesting is that you cross-program that parking with other things. Cross-program it with community facilities. Make it a park. Introduce low-impact development technology where you can use soft surfaces, landscape system, wetland plant communities to actually mitigate stormwater runoff. It's very important. Stormwater runoff, the first hour of stormwater runoff has a pollution index twice that of raw sewage. And so what we're suggesting is that the parking lot itself can become a sponge that remediates water runoff, urban water, stormwater runoff from the site and become a park at the same time. So even when a parking lot is empty, it could be a fantastic place to jog, to picnic, to use as a park. And so partnering with communities to create good open green spaces. And again, this is, you know, it's not just for big box, but for any large program, particularly churches, which only use the parking 1 or 2 days a week. Then the inner parking realm and the building frontage, the parking 60% of the big box development, and yet it becomes a great opportunity for wayfinding, advertising, and messaging. And the great shopping anthropologist Paco Hill tells us that the parking lot is the biggest missed opportunity in the retail experience. The parking lot can sponsor so many other things. And we actually look at Walmart's early history. Sam Walton actually used the parking lot as a retail venue. Often used it as a county fairgrounds, as an open market system where other retailers and himself would sell things, much like in a flea market. But that tradition has been lost. The parking lot, again, has become a smooth space that doesn't sponsor any kind of complexity. And so what we're suggesting is that we could look at shared streets, courtyards, retail loops within the parking lot space itself. With slow traffic, it would actually put motors and traffic together in a much more productive way than happens now. The building frontage, of course, is the most important moment in defining a public space, and I'll speak to that through the second design instrument, which is about introducing new kinds of frontages. And as you can see here, these are just best practices that the students and center developed. They're by no means exhaustive. They're really talking points that hopefully will add up to a kind of catalog of possibilities that can be selected to create a context-sensitive big box development. The historic decompression zone, that zone that Paco Underhill talks about, is the first 40 feet of the store in which no retail decision is made, because as a person moves from inside to outside and vice versa, from outside to inside rather, your attention is focused on getting to the middle or to the rear of the store. And so absolutely no messaging is effective in that first 40 feet. So we tell Walmart, since most of your stores look like you're walking into a closet, why not just reverse that and make it the biggest architectural event? Take the garden center and make the garden center an atrium for moving into the store. So the garden center is not just a retail moment, but it's also an architectural moment in which you can develop as a glass atrium full of plants. And this could be a way to create a really wonderful porosity between inside and outside. And of course, this adds up to a matrix of possibilities. We had 8 students and 5 ecotones. And so this is really an open-ended, flexible model in which we can develop point-by-point context sensitivity based upon site, climate, size of store, and the condition of the context. I want to talk about design instrument 2. And what we did was, except for the sponge, what we did was look at analogies. There are analogous community development systems, a porch, an atrium, courtyard loops, courtyard bars, conservancies, and arcades, by no means exhaustive again. But look at those conditions in architecture and planning that offer models that speak to history, speak to identity, speak to social custom. These are architectural moments which are not prescribed, but facilitate a lot of social complexity. And we know how to exist within those spaces. And this is very important. Marc Auger talks about this in his book, Non-Places, the introduction to the anthropology of supermodernity. And what Auger discusses is this intersection between non-places defined by malls, transportation, airports, generic places, and the intersection with place elements like the ports and aloja. And what he suggests is infecting one with the other as a way of challenging the non-place. And so that's what we're suggesting with these models here. So in the first one, and again, it's really about expanding porosity, which in the end expands the retail opportunity, by the way. But expanding the porosity, having the front of the store become part of a community device that starts to define the context. In this one, there's a proposal to take that garden center as a kind of conservatory and arcade, move it to the entry, make that the entry, and of course you can see it, all the permutations of the porch, arcade, and conservatory that can happen. So it's very context sensitive. That can be manipulated in ways that are responding to local conditions. The courtyard bar, looking at Mideastern cities and the role of the courtyard, both the private and the public courtyard, the interiorized space, as a way of defining the front of the store. Walmart really is trying to figure out how to make their stores more community directed, again, in a tradition that they were in the 60s, where they would host events, they would host farmers markets, they would host particularly other merchants that don't compete with their product offering. They want to host community events, little league events, fundraising, bake sales, informal events that could occupy these bars. But at this point, there's no thinking on how to accommodate those within the smoothness of their big box model. And so what we're suggesting in the courtyard bar is that you begin with the frontage, you plug the big box into that, but it's the frontage that defines space, the retail, the exterior retail space, and also possibilities for plugging into the context. And you can see here in the bottom right, the possibility of a power center, which are very common now. Big boxers want to collect in the same places and zones outside of cities. And so we're suggesting that the power center could be a community-making device. The promenade, just looking at movement, great movement systems like the Galleria in Milan, and really use that as a device to organize a chain of retailers that are typically happening now throughout their properties. Walmart has partner retailers that they tend to sponsor in their stores now, particularly McDonald's. And what this is doing, there's nothing novel here. This is really just about recalling lost intelligence. It's really looking back at historical ideas about the role of the marketplace in the city and the role of architecture in sponsoring the kind of social complexity that markets were always characterized by. Looking at loops, retail loops, this is something that other retailers have done, but because the big box is so daunting and big, a lot of retailers now are developing dedicated loops in which certain product offerings would be made. So you could have a convenience store loop within a big box in which you follow that loop You would find all the ingredients typical in a small convenience store. So it becomes a very complex way, a very layered way of establishing retail. We're suggesting that those loops move out into the exterior space. The atrium, very straightforward. Again, move certain product offerings. Use the instead of putting the atrium on the side of the building, actually invest a little more in the architecture of it and move it to the entry and the exit of the building. And then the sponge was the only non-architectural analogy, but we like the sponge because it suggests, again, the porosity that we're looking for. And so, again, Walmart now develops a lot of allied retailer opportunity, and a lot of them are local retailers. They sponsor shoe shops, eyewear, souvenir shops. And so really looking at designing those shops, those smaller scales, in with the store itself. And again, all the permutations that that could take. Now, Walmart tells us that that they're not interested in being a developer. They're not interested in taking on other uses. In this study, we've discussed with them the possibility of introducing mixed use, of introducing housing. That's not a possibility right now. And actually, it goes back to the problem of bigness and smoothness. You recall that Walt Disney said the same thing in his original conception of theme parks. Those theme parks were to have housing and really reflect the complexity of the city. And of course, that didn't happen. He found that housing and the messiness of the city and the polity was far too difficult, so they became theme parks only. Subsequently, Celebration was developed as a separate entity. But we took the opportunity to show how big box could fit within an urban context. And here, really looking at the parking lot as a park, and a shared opportunity. And so I think that's the next step for Walmart is to figure out, without losing the parking, how to share parking, how to imbricate itself with other uses. But I think this is gonna occur one step at a time. Thank you.
Good afternoon, my name is David Greisel. I am at the moment facing the hazard of being the third presenter, that we have about 10 minutes left for my 15 to 20 minute speech. So I would like to propose a deal with you. My proposal is this. If you will give me 15 minutes, I will do this in 15 minutes. Is it a deal? All right. It's a deal. Here we go. I'm with HOK Sport Venue Event. We're the world's largest designers of public assembly facilities, stadiums, arenas, and convention centers. Why is there an elephant on the screen? You know the kindergartner's joke, why do elephants wear red sneakers? Anybody know the answer to that?
I never went to kindergarten.
Oh, okay, I didn't go to kindergarten. The answer is that elephants wear red sneakers so that they can hide in strawberry patches. The projects we're going to be talking about are very much like elephants in red sneakers. They're hard to hide in the strawberry patches of big cities. Obviously, sports facilities are not a new building type. Wanted to remind you of that. But also wanted to remind you that sports facilities in particular have a wonderful history of being great urbanism, not just good urbanism, but great urbanism. Buildings you may not be familiar with, like Sportsman's Park in St. Louis, Scheib Park in Philadelphia, one of the great old, dearly departed ballparks, and Forbes Field in Pittsburgh. This is one of my all-time favorite images of people going to a baseball game, women wearing flowered hats, men in top hats, carriages and horseless carriages all arriving at the ball game. And then, of course, as you know, stadiums went through kind of an unfortunate period, let's say, after World War II, where parking became the dominant driver of urban form for stadiums, including the Astrodome. And even urban stadiums, like Three Rivers Stadium, which was literally right downtown in Pittsburgh, became determined by automobiles and automobile access. So this was the context of Three Rivers Stadium in Pittsburgh. Asphalt as far as the eye could see at ground level, and elevated expressways carrying cars to and from the site, a very unfortunate circumstance. Some of the challenges that face designers of very large public assembly buildings are these. I'm going to go through these very quickly. Massive footprint, huge vertical scale. Typically in our buildings, one story is 30 feet tall or more. Multi-block sites, the demand for parking, obviously, how you deal with pedestrian flow and their very internalized programs. Just some quick examples of what I'm talking about. Here's a map of downtown Indianapolis, the giant orange blob in the lower left there is the Indiana Convention Center and RCA Dome. There's a pointer. That's sort of typical of how these buildings occupy downtown sites. It's not all that unusual. In fact, there are buildings that have larger sites than that. They do tend to be scale challenged. This is our Reliance Stadium in Houston. You can see the people there in the foreground and how these buildings just they tend to be massive. Obviously, as a designer, you can choose to emphasize that massiveness or not. And sometimes they impact street grids in very negative ways. This is the American Center in St. Louis, actually the first phase of that when it was called Cervantes Convention Center. Not a great urban intervention in terms of how it addresses this street that just sort of abruptly ends at the wall of the building. Even parking is a big challenge with these facilities, and even a project that's been hailed as much as Camden Yards has been hailed, you can see has to deal with VIP parking at the very least, a small parking lot for suite holders and premium seat holders that tends to make the urban experience a little bit less wonderful than you would like. Likewise, pedestrian flow is a challenge. The big challenge here is just dealing with the masses of people. Sidewalks tend to get wider and widest, sometimes as wide as 50 feet to properly handle the volume of pedestrians that are coming in and out of these buildings. And they do tend to have a very internalized program, which makes activating the street a challenge in itself because everything is inward focused towards the event, towards the playing field or the court. You see here at the what used to be called the Sky Dome in Toronto, at what used to be Bank One Ballpark in Phoenix, a very internalized program. Then around 1992, something good happened. The good thing was Camden Yards in Baltimore kind of redefined the way we think about ballparks and cities, kind of reminded us of what was great about ballparks in the first place. Joe Spear, the designer of Camden Yards, said, "The intent is that it fit in and be a good neighbor. It's like a 10,000-pound elephant. It won't disappear into the background like an elephant in red tennis shoes, but it is respectful of its surroundings." So to wrap up very quickly with what creates good urbanism in giant public assembly buildings, I've identified these six or seven points. Squeeze the site, respect the grid even as you violate it, honor the pedestrian, recognize the context, build to the street, sort of, break down the scale, and integrate the fabric. So let me show you what I'm talking about with these. Squeeze the site. One of our most successful urban ballparks is, it's now called AT&T Park in San Francisco, which is built on China Basin in a obviously very, very urban area in San Francisco. There's China Basin. Now known as McCovey Cove, where the home runs can go because of the very short right field dimension here. But in fact, the very small site here is what makes this a wonderful ballpark. This is the smallest site we've ever done a major league facility on. It's about 9 acres, and it really made for a obviously very challenging design process, but also a very wonderful design that is very urban and integrates extremely well into the small scale and fine grain of downtown San Francisco. Second point, respect the grid even as you violate it. The site for Minute Maid Park in Houston, Texas, for which I was a project designer, is 9 acres in downtown Houston inside the freeway loop. And obviously, we can't have the street grid running through our ballpark. That doesn't really work. So we had to consolidate this site and create one big block out of 9 little blocks. The blocks in Houston, by the way, are extremely small. They're only about 250 feet on a side, which is why we needed 9 of them instead of 4, which would be more typical. So we're violating the grid by consolidating this mega block, but we're also respecting the grid. Let me show you what I mean by that. First of all, this is the ballpark site, and you can see we're terminating two streets here, actually one street here, and there would be streets over there if there wasn't Highway 59. But we're responding to the grid by making all of those very important events in the ballpark design. For instance, Avenida de las Americas, which runs past the George R. Brown Convention Center, and this part of it didn't even exist when we built the ballpark, we anticipated the extension of this boulevard right into the front door of the ballpark, so this becomes a major entrance to Minute Maid Park. Likewise, every street that terminates at the ballpark is acknowledged with a major ballpark entrance. This is one of them, but every single street that we terminate, we also acknowledge. So that's what I mean by respect the grid even as you violate it. Honoring the pedestrian is my third point. Coors Field in Denver is a good example of that. What I love about this ballpark is the amount of detail and richness that is in the facade of the building, particularly down at street level where the people are. It really honors the human and the human scale. This is a not very good photograph, but it really gives you an idea of how much thought and attention went into the design of the facade of this ballpark. Obviously a very large building, over 1 million square feet, but a great deal of attention paid to stuff down at the street level, like the emblems on the iron gates that people exit after the game is over and things like that. Recognizing the context, sort of an example from the bad old days, Busch Stadium in St. Louis, 1966, round peg in a square hole, if ever there was one. If you ever saw a site plan of this, you would see how it also distorted the street grid in order to fit this round peg into the square hole, all very unfortunate urban conditions. New Busch Stadium, on the other hand, really does fit into the urban grid in a much nicer way than the old stadium did, which you can just see that's the old stadium superimposed on what is now being developed as Ballpark Village, a six-block area of mixed-use urban development that's happening as part of the ballpark development. So recognizing the context means this building relates much more nicely to the large brick historic warehouses that were in the neighborhood of Busch Stadium when it was built in the first place. The older Busch Stadium was more of a statement about Edward Larrabee Barnes. But the context doesn't always have to be brick warehouses. This is Jacobs Field in Cleveland, another nice urban ballpark with a very contemporary vocabulary. But the contemporary vocabulary is really all about the steelwork and the bridges and the industrial heritage of Cleveland. That was really what was the inspiration for these images of the ballpark. So context doesn't always have to be brick warehouses. It doesn't even have to be buildings. At the Phoenix Convention Center, the context that we recognized was actually the exciting, colorful, sculptural geography and geology of Arizona. That's what's being celebrated in this building, as you can see with the colored layers of stone on the facade. It's really all about the geology of Arizona more than it is about any particular building or set of buildings in downtown Phoenix. Building to the street, sort of. What do I mean by that? Well, obviously, as a good urbanist, you would like to build to the street line, but because these buildings are so large and so important, sometimes that's not always the appropriate thing to do. A good example of that is the America Center in St. Louis, where you can see the facade curves back from the sidewalk in what I think is a brilliant urban design strategy to create a little civic place, not a very big civic place, but a small civic place that acknowledges the importance of the building, acknowledges the presence of crowds in front of the building, while still respecting the urban street wall. So that's what I mean by build to the street, sort of. You want to build to the street line, but not all the way to the street line. Another example of that is at Coors Field. Again, we've got the 50-foot wide sidewalks. But when you step back from that and look at the building as a whole, it still feels like an urban building. So you don't get that sense that it's set way back like the Astrodome, for example. It still feels urban even though there are 50-foot wide sidewalks in front of it. Breaking down the scale, this is a huge issue, and I think one where we have had varying degrees of success at HOK Sport Venue Event. I think a successful project is the Fort Worth Convention Center, where we really very intentionally attempted to mirror the small scale of buildings in downtown Fort Worth on this facade, particularly with the horizontal and vertical divisions of the facade into lots of much smaller geometric shapes. It doesn't read like a 1,000-foot long facade, which is what I like about it. Likewise, at Minute Maid Park in Houston, this is a view down Texas Avenue There's an old hotel in the foreground, the historic Union Station in the middle ground, and then you can see the ballpark just barely in the background where we really brought the scale. This is a retractable roof ballpark where you can just barely see the retractable roof popping up above those building forms there. As you move a little closer, you can see a little bit more of the ballpark, a little bit more of Union Station, and you can see how we broke down the scale of this 900-foot-long facade into several sub-buildings that reflect and actually repeat the rhythm of Union Station going down Texas Avenue, so it doesn't feel like just a 900-foot-long building. And then just a closer view of the ballpark itself, same point. So, integrating the fabric. Camden Yards was really the pioneer of this idea. Integrating the B&O warehouse into the ballpark experience really made Camden Yards a unique place to watch baseball in America. We've done that at a couple of other places. In Petco Park in San Diego, if you look carefully, you'll see the old Western Metal Supply building that actually became a block of suites out in left field that worked out really well for us in San Diego. And likewise, in Houston, you can see the historic Union Station as well as the rest of downtown Houston from the Seating Bowl. And in fact, Drayton McLean's office is right there, the owners of the Astros. He's got a sign on it that says if you can hit the ball like 541 feet, you can break his window. So far, nobody's done that yet. But it's a nice way of integrating something historic and very much a part of Houston's history into the ballpark experience. So I'm going to wrap up in the next 2-3 minutes with one case study where I think we kind of bring all these urban ideas together into one particular project, and that project is PNC Park, home of the Pittsburgh Pirates. Squeeze the site. You can see that the site for PNC Park is physically smaller than the site for Three Rivers Stadium, which is the facility that it replaced. Respect the grid even as you violated it. In the urban design plan that was developed for PNC Park, the street grid, which had been absent from this part of Pittsburgh, was literally reestablished, rebuilding the streets that used to be there and are there now. Then this is a shot of the North Shore of Pittsburgh, the before picture. You see all the parking for Three Rivers over on the side here. This is the after picture of PNC Park restoring the grid. Again, this is the Isabella Street entrance. There's a street that terminates at the east side of PNC Park. It becomes a major entrance to the ballpark. There's a statue of Willie Stargell right there to acknowledge the importance of that. Honoring the pedestrian, the Roberto Clemente Bridge is actually closed on game days and becomes a pedestrian way for people to get from downtown parking resources across the Allegheny River to approach the ballpark. It's a very popular way to approach the ballpark. The home plate entrance, interestingly, doesn't really face much of anything, but it really is a pedestrian-scaled place to enter the ballpark. Again, we got the statue of Honus Wagner there in the corner. And the level of detail, similar to Coors Field, is all down at the street level where the people are. Recognizing the context, I confess to being very inspired by the Allegheny County Courthouse designed by H.H. Richardson and the design of PNC Park. In my studies of Pittsburgh, I came to realize that all the best buildings in Pittsburgh were stone buildings, kind of a buff-colored stone, the Allegheny Courthouse being the most prominent example. And so I suggested to the Pirates that really for a building of this scale and importance, stone was the right material to use, and they agreed with that. So I was very happy that we were able to put a stone facade on this building instead of the traditional red brick. Build to the street sort of along Federal Street. In order to get the 50-foot wide sidewalks, we actually carved an arcade into the building to help make it more pedestrian accessible. Break down the scale. This building's about 120 feet tall along General Robinson Street, but as you move towards the river, you can see how it steps down from that to 4 stories, to 3 stories, to 2 stories, to no stories at the river, intentionally bringing the building down in scale as you get closer and closer to the river. And integrating the context, that's where I'm going to end. The best way to integrate context into a ballpark project is literally to bring the city into the ballpark, and that's one of the things I think PNC Parks works best at, is if you have the chance to go there, sit on the third base side on a summer evening. It is the most spectacular place in America to watch baseball. Thank you very much for your patience.
David, you're very gracious. Thank you. Let's take 5 minutes of questions, or anybody, or not. The question is, what's the reaction of Walmart to what Steve has shown so far?
They offered me a job, and the problem is it never really got out of the design department. They were not a proponent for it because it's not a very empowered unit within Walmart. So it hasn't gone too far.
The question is, was there an underground concourse available to go from building to build, from parking to building?
Yeah, there actually is. There's a service tunnel as well as a tunnel for movement of patients, but there is a water table that precludes from going very deep into the ground.
Here. Question was, what do they really need? Not, is it 5 per 1,000?
You do need the 5 after Thanksgiving and before Christmas, maybe 2 weekends a year. But for the most part, and they haven't done traffic studies on it, but I suspect that, you know, you can get away with 2.5 spaces. No, we kept the 5 spaces, but as far as splitting hard surface, soft surface, we reflected the capacity that they use on a daily level through, you know, asphalt versus gravel, grass pave. And so they do need the 5 spaces, again, for 2% of the year. That difference between capacity became park space. But you could still use it to park.
Here in the black.
Related question, before I kind of jump on that. You say need. Is need synonymous with require? What is their bottom line if they say, we've got to have it? Will they accept the 2.5? Getting the peak, designing the box, we're trying to get away from designing the peak and make people look around for that last part.
That's right. Well, the thing is, they will do what the community tells them to do. And right now, their codes are pretty much synonymous with local codes. So if a community puts pressure on them to do something different, that's when they'll start to bend.
Over here on the right. Did they ever look at parking on the roof?
Parking on the roof, good question. You know, that would be about $25,000 to $30,000 a space. It's unfeasible for their business model.
Here in the white.
When you put together a very intensive business use, a hospital and a sports facility, you get a state university. How do you deal with the ultimate gigantic model that actually has quasi-municipal powers and houses 10,000 or more people on its corporate property?
How do you deal with a public university is the question.
I have a response to that. Hire different architects. The worst colleges in America are the ones that were all designed by the same architect, particularly community colleges. They always have the worst campuses. So I'd say hire lots of different architects and take your chances.
Okay. Now, here, actually, behind, because I think you asked one before.
What's great about urban ballparks is the parking story, and of course I didn't have time to go into that today, but you know, the Astrodome had 25,000 parking spaces in a parking lot, which was impossible to get out of after a game. Within the same size rectangle of Minute Maid Park in Houston, there are the same number of parking spaces, all privately owned, and you can choose how much you want to spend on parking, whether you want to spend $5, $10, $15, or $20, depending on how close you want to be. And after the game's over, the urban grid makes the traffic go away. It's incredible how well it works. What? No, that's what, no. That's what I said. There were 25,000 existing parking spaces around Minute Maid Park. We only built a couple of thousand parking spaces for the VIP people, and those spaces are actually going away as the site gets developed.
Wow. Here. How much can Walmart afford for parking space, including land? And then we'll take one more after this.
Yeah, it's a good question. That I don't know. And they haven't done studies to really show the break-even point. But their business models, the profit margins are only 3%. But their business model is very inefficient. And I'll give you a fact on that, is that in Lancaster, PA, they've spent millions of dollars over the last 10 years just to get a store opened in that area. They spent it all on attorney fees. Had they accomplished better design, they could have saved that money in attorney fees and put it to property development. But there's no real studies which show what their thresholds are, because ironically they operate fairly inefficiently.
Right back here.
Well, it would be interesting to see who subsidized what. When they do something different, they get a lot of subsidies to do that. So it would be interesting to see who paid for the parking, who paid for the price differential, because right now their business model can't really withstand urban sites. And when it does happen, it's usually in partnership with other investors and other developers. But as far as a kind of run-of-the-mill super center, they couldn't do that. For instance, their McKinney store, which was a $30 million center, and most of their super centers come in at $20 million, they could only afford to build that one center as a demonstration project to show new alternative energy technologies. They couldn't afford to do that in all of their stores. So some stores become loss projects, loss leader projects, which are trying to show new models. But it couldn't be done anywhere.
Okay, Mark Twain said, it's a terrible death to be talked to death, so we won't do that to you. Thank you for coming.
Good job, guys. Good job.